Testing, 1, 2, testing. You'll hear more of my favorite song a little bit later. People know Pink. What about us? So I am so honored to be here to share what I've learned around taking care of myself and helping to create a culture of wellness. I am so honored. I want to thank Bonnie, Jake, the whole education committee, the planning committee, and the leadership of STFM for prioritizing this topic, for prioritizing us. So thank you very much. I also want to thank each one of you for the care that you give to your patients and your team members. But more importantly today, I want to thank you for the care that you give to yourself in order to provide the best care to your patients and your team members. So thank you. In the 25 years that I have been a family physician, this is the most rewarding work that I have ever done. Not that I don't value teaching on depression, education, diabetes, vaginitis, but there are two major benefits to talking about wellness. First of all, I have to walk the walk. And cheers to those who walked the walk this morning, or ran the ran, congratulations. But cheers to those who also chose to replenish by sleeping in a little. The other benefit is the universal value and appreciation that I have seen from my colleagues, all of you, for the time to think about yourself, to reflect, whether it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, or a two-hour workshop, or a half-day workshop. It is so rewarding to see across professions, physicians, students, residents, nurses, social workers, care coordinators needing this work. So I am very appreciative of the opportunity to share with all of you. I have no disclosures. I was asked to start with a little bit of my journey, and particularly for students. We have 100 students out there. Awesome. So this is my journey. Not everybody who's born in Camden, New Jersey admits it. I was born in Camden, New Jersey, grew up there. I went to Jefferson Medical College, and that was really the highlight of my career in family medicine, identifying everybody was family medicine at Jefferson. The president of the hospital was family medicine. And I had a fantastic preceptorship. When we talk about the impact of these preceptorships, I was sent with two private practice family physicians, husbands and wives, for my clerkship to Palo Alto, and there was never a question in my mind that I was going to do family medicine. I finished an opportunity to work with the World Health Organization at that time, which was so unusual, but I got to start to begin my interest in not only preventive care, but in public health, working in Thailand. And then did a residency with many, again, excellent mentors and role models in Charleston at MUSC, and had the opportunity under Dr. Brock, who was a Balant leader, but also from South Africa, to work in his hometown during the apartheid in the 80s, as well as opportunities to work in Honduras. From that point, I went to a faculty development fellowship at UNC in Chapel Hill, and again, continued to see this amazing series of mentors in family medicine. I had a very short stint in private practice in Southwest Georgia under Joe Hobbs, Lanny Copeland, and many, again, wonderful mentors, and then have spent the majority of my career up at Dartmouth in New Hampshire. STFM has been my home academically, in addition to Dartmouth, since my 21-year-old daughter was born. I remember carrying her in my arms to STFM meetings, and that has taken me all over, including my work with AAMC. The family medicine work has taken me to Alaska and Tuksuk, and I've done a lot of work now both on starting family medicine residency programs as well as wellness programs across different countries, including China recently. The last section that just went up is where my three family members, because I'm an empty nester this year, which is an interesting concept for me, but my oldest daughter is up at Middlebury, she's a senior. My husband is now doing research in Cambridge, he's an oncologist, and my youngest daughter is now a Bucknell freshman. And so on Sunday I will be challenged to cheer for my home Philadelphia roots or the Patriots. I'll decide between now and then. But when this started, the culminating piece for me around burnout personally and around teaching on wellness began in 2011 when I, with a full-time job, all of the different things that Jake mentioned, took on a Master's of Public Health at Dartmouth at the Dartmouth Institute. And I was sitting at graduation, not with the faculty that I typically sat with, but with a group of students with my cap on. And I was looking around the room, and I was listening to the graduation speaker, as many of you have done, and they're saying, go forth, change the world, cure cancer, redesign healthcare. And I'm looking at my colleagues who haven't been sleeping, who haven't been eating healthy, who aren't exercising, who are sometimes taking medication that they wish they were prescribing only for students or for patients. And I thought to myself the words of Pink, which I didn't know at that time, what about us? Where's the message to take care of ourselves? They've been putting things off for so long, saying, when I graduate, someday I'll take care of myself. So I have three objectives this morning. I'm going to talk about the importance of self-care, but particularly the impact that it has, not only on me as an individual and you as an individual, but our teams, our communities, and our patients, therefore our entire society and population. And I'm talking about the factors, because as we begin to understand that, we have to know why, and we'll ask the why question a few times. And then lastly, we'll start to explore strategies for changing this, both at the individual level as well as the system level. We will just be exploring it and touching the surface. If those who want to dive deeper, I'll be doing a workshop this afternoon at 3:30 to get into applying some of those and being able to demonstrate some of those strategies personally. So I hope that some of you will join me this afternoon. So the premise of all of this is this basic statement. My health is critical to my effectiveness as a, fill in the blank, as a mother, as a wife, as a teacher, as a clinician, as a researcher, as a leader, as an educator, anything I want to be, I am better at being if I am healthy. So let me just define health in the way that is being used broadly when we're talking about this topic. We're thinking of it just the same way Dr. Levine said yesterday with the Institute of Medicine World Health Organization definitions. It's not just the absence of disease. When we talk about health, we're talking synonymously about wellness, and we're talking about it in a very, very broad way. So not just the physical health that I've slept well, that I'm eating, that I'm exercising, but social health, that I have a connection, that I'm part of a group like STFM where I feel like I belong, that I have a spiritual sense, something higher than myself that I believe in, that I have satisfaction in my work, not only financial stability, but also the ability to have work-life balance, that I'm doing something purposeful, that in my environment, both physical and natural, is not harmful to me, that it's not toxic. I have a supportive environment. Intellectually, I never worry about that with my students or colleagues, but I do worry about it with my retirees. Again, thinking about the intellectual health, am I stimulated? And then my emotional health, which for many of us is some of the difficult, to feel the emotions, to be authentic. And so this makes up the entire picture of wellness. So I'm going to start by just showing you some of the challenges. And you're probably familiar with a little bit, so I want to highlight some of the real data that is moving this movement across the nation. So I'm going to come over here so you can see my pointer. So I'm going to start at the top. And this work was done by Tate Schoenfeld, who was previously at Mayo, and he's now at Stanford as the chief wellness officer. We'll come back to that concept. So they're looking from 2011 to 2014 at the self-reported burnout of any working population. So in the general population, it's about 28% and flat over that period of time. So that's not good. Almost 30% of our general working people report themselves burnout. But worse than that is the physicians, and we've gone from about 45 to 54 and increasing. So more than half of us are reporting burnout. Same thing with work-life balance. The general population, 60%, and slightly increased, but holding. Whereas the balance, the reported work-life balance of physicians, has gone from 40% down. So let's start at the beginning. Show of hands of students again. Any first years? No, you're all third and fourth years, good. So this is not just present in the physicians, this is present in students, residents, nurses, researchers. Consistent, the data shows that over 50% of all health professionals are reporting burnout. So when we begin at pre-med, and we look at, the red is our medical students, the blue is their peers. their non-pre-med peers at college age. Our medical students do better pre-medical school than any of their peers in overall quality of life, mental quality of life, physical and emotional. Interesting. Our medical students, again in red, have less burnout than their peers pre-medical school and less depression than their peers pre-medical school. Interesting. What's in the water? So when you look at the education as a protective factor, it's really potent. If you go beyond high school, which is what we're comparing to, and get a bachelor's degree, you have an odds ratio of 0.8, 20% less likely to be burned out by going to college. Nice, as expected. A master's degree, 30% less likely to be burned out. Lots of complex reasons. A doctorate degree, not an MD or DO, but a professional doctorate degree, 40% less likely to be burned out. What's the exception? Us. 40% more likely to be burned out. What's in the water? What is it in our culture that makes this occur? So the students always ask me, okay, well, which specialty should I choose that's gonna keep me from being in that bucket? I don't wanna be burned out. Where do I go? What specialty? There is no specialty that is immune to this. There is no specialty immune to this. I am unhappy to report that we are number four here, family medicine at the top, but in the same study Schoenfeld did from 2011 to 2014, every single specialty worsened. So again, you can see our internal medicine colleagues here, our pediatric general colleagues slightly lower, but on average, over 50% of all physicians reporting burnout. This is probably the most concerning from my perspective, is that when you ask how well we screen ourselves, we do poorly. So we know the data, we know how to screen, we do it very well for others, but we don't screen ourselves well. So physicians do not reliably self-assess. So that combination's not good, right? So what does this look like? What does burnout look like? This is one of the definitions: progressive loss of idealism, energy, and purpose experienced particularly by people in the helping profession as a result of the conditions of their work. So how many of you, with a show of your right hand, know somebody that you may be concerned about being burned out? Keep that hand up. How many of you on your left hand have been concerned about yourself and burnout? Oh my, hey, if you had a photo from this direction, it would not be pretty. So what does this look like when we think about it? And it could be a student, it could be a resident, it could be a faculty member. They show up on day one, they're excited, they're energetic, they're volunteering. Sure, I'll be on that committee. They're engaged, they want to participate, they want to do well, and they're succeeding, right? They're well, they're healthy in that broad sense. But somewhere down the line, they stop engaging. They don't volunteer. They don't show up. They don't want to be bothered. And often what I hear is, he just doesn't seem to care anymore. She doesn't care. She just doesn't seem to care. Whoa. Again, 50% students, residents, nurses, everyone that we're associated with all day long is experiencing this. So one of the screening questions, again, if we're not good at screening it, we need to be clear on this. This is a 22-item survey, which most of us can't remember 22 items. I know I can't. They're broken into three categories, again, around emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, and then the reverse being low on personal accomplishments or sense of purpose. But many institutions are using these as big screenings. I keep it simple. This one question, do you feel burned out from your work? It's sensitive and specific. Do you feel burned out from your work? That's it. That's all we need to ask. And if the answer is yes, we're concerned. So I don't ever want to be cynical, but I look at some of our hospitals and I say, what's the impact of this? We're one of the only professions that actually doesn't put our own health first. Don't know why. Again, what's in the water? But when you think about the impact, we first look at the individual. So the individual who's burned out is going to have lots of side effects. So job dissatisfaction, anxiety, sleep, musculoskeletal, mental health issues, substance abuse, depression, and suicide, right? I had 2 suicides in my medical school class. I had 2 suicides in my residency. And I've had 2 suicides in physicians since I've been at Dartmouth. And I know you all have similar stories. But it's beyond us. And this is why it's becoming a movement. This is why it's becoming a priority, because it's affecting the organizations. It's affecting their performance, absenteeism. We're not there, presenteeism. We're there, but we're not performing. It is becoming a business issue. It is a financial issue. It's about $500,000 to replace a physician in the recruitment process, the lost productivity, et cetera, et cetera. And it is a huge loss in dollars. And we know what speaks at the dollar level, right? It's also, and again, this is my belief of what's important, so maybe this is the reason that it's becoming an issue across organizations nationally and internationally. It affects our patients. We can't argue with the data now. When we are burned out, our patients are getting poor care. And I believe personally that even if our way of thinking is that my patient comes first, this will motivate us to put ourselves first. Because if my tank is not full, I cannot provide optimal care to others. So I need to care for myself to get the patient optimal outcomes. So I think Dr. Levine would agree that this is equally a public health crisis. When you look at the numbers, 50% of all of these groups, it's hundreds of thousands of people that are not performing at their optimal level. So my training, particularly through the Dartmouth Institute, is around quality improvement. And that's how I look at all of these issues. Okay, so what do we do? How do we fix this? And I'm trained to look at the root causes. And that, are people familiar with quality improvement processes? Absolutely. These can be applied to ourselves and our systems equally. So we ask those 5 questions, why, just like a 2-year-old, right? And we try and get to the root. We're going to dive a lot deeper into this afternoon in the workshop and looking at both individual and systems factors. But some of the factors are very complex, but we need to understand those if we're going to come up with solutions and strategies. We need to understand what are the factors that threaten us individually, and again, all of these different aspects of wellness. So what are some cultural beliefs, right? We're invincible. You know, doctors don't need that. Well, we don't need that. You know, what are our thoughts? Patients first. If I ask for help, I'm weak, and I put some more burden on other people. Right? We don't want to do that. What are our behaviors? Well, I'll just isolate myself. Or I'll work through lunch. I'll work through the weekend. I'll work right through my vacation. We have very unhealthy behaviors at times. Personality, we know we bring them in. You know, we're overridden by guilt and perfectionism. We want to make sure it's right. Great qualities, but not when taken to the extreme. Knowledge is one that's interesting. People say, is it that we don't know enough? There could be that sometimes. How many people have read When Breath Becomes Air? Fantastic book if you haven't read it. And it struck me that this very experienced physician says at one time, I'm 35, I'm a non-smoker, I have a 0.0012 likelihood of lung cancer. So knowledge can actually hurt us sometimes, right? We know too much, so we won't get colon cancer, we can skip our colonoscopy. We'll be okay. We can skip a pap, you know, we're extending that. We can just go another 5, whatever, years, 10 maybe. And then emotions, you know, again, denying, anger, guilt, all of those emotions that play into this that cause us to resent and resist. Same thing when we start to look at the system level. What are those things? And the literature's starting to bubble up. We love to point our finger. The one thing we want to point our finger at is the EMR, right? It's that EMR's fault. The overwhelming clinical roles, the overwhelming administrative roles have surfaced as a major factor playing into this. And there are some structural factors. There's lots of different things that play into this. But understanding those unique to the context of you as an individual and your system is critical to being able to move forward with this. Remember Don Berwick, who's charged us all with the triple aim, right? So this is what we work to every day. We always are working to better care, better health, lower cost. Well, I'm going with Tom Bodenheimer. Tom Bodenheimer said, you know what? We will never, never, never achieve the triple aim if we do it on our own backs. If we do it at the expense of ourselves and our team members, we will not get there. We need to prioritize our own health. So take care of ourselves. and we will be stronger for it. We will be better prepared to care for others. So as the literature comes out, we ask ourselves, what are strategies? And I bet every one of you, and again, we'll dive deep into this afternoon, every one of you has a personal strategy that works for you, maybe some that don't, but you've also probably seen role models. And there may be some out there, they may be closet role models. They may be in the gym. I often hear that. I went to the gym and everybody's like, oh, you didn't see me, you didn't see me. But what are the strategies that your role models use? And what are the strategies that you use? And when we look into the literature, again, this is a systematic review that just came out. Tate Schoenfeld, and again, Colin West, these are the experts in these areas. Their conclusion is we need strategies to do both. So here's where the debate is happening in our country right now. Should the individual be responsible? This is your problem, you go fix it. And a lot of the hospitals are taking the approach that we'll set up a yoga class at lunch and we'll have all of these little things, the check boxes are there. Whether you can use it or not, it doesn't matter. This is your responsibility to do it. And the flip side is, this is an environment that needs to change in order for the individual who's trying very hard to succeed. I probably, as many places, I stand in the middle. Even in New Hampshire, I'm not on either side of the fence. I stand in the middle and I say, I need to be responsible for this. And who is the system? I am the system. So we need to be responsible as champions in this to change our system, because systems don't exist without people. And the systems won't change unless we are champions leading the effort. And the president of the hospital and the deans of the hospital and all of the leaders in the medical school and the residencies and the faculty are taking care of themselves and being proud to do so, showing others that this is good. That's how systems change. Thank you, I'm gonna clap too. So we can't point our finger, but we also have to hold ourselves accountable. And we're gonna see some amazing things. I just added this slide, actually, because this came out in the New England Journal January 25th, this past week, was bubbling with articles around this. So we're seeing lots of things happening out there. So not only on the med school level, schools are saying system-wide, pass-fail. Although I did hear one school that says pass-fail, but it's still posted what your number is somewhere. That's not quite pass-fail. Institutions who are developing MA programs, where the MAs work as scribes, Colorado. Stanford now has, as I mentioned, Tate Schoenfeld, a CWO. How many of you have a CWO at your organization? One. Are you at Stanford? Awesome. I do not have a CWO, but I would love one. I've put in a recommendation at Dartmouth that we should have a CWO. Again, what is the job of the CWO? A chief wellness officer. To set the metrics around wellness equal to the other metrics. So I was at a conference in DC. Jayco was present, and we had a discussion around what these metrics might look like that would be at the highest level. So I would be responsible to them, to my chair. My chair would be responsible to the organization. The organization would be ranked upon these metrics. What could they be? They could be, do all your employees take vacation? Your hospital's ranked higher. Are they off when they're off? Are they not using their pagers when they're off? Are they covering one another? Are they not on task when they're on the weekends? So these are lots of different, turn everything upside down and think about how we measure our success. Lots of ideas. This organization, National Academy of Medicine, previously Institute of Medicine, is taking this seriously, as is the AAMC, as is pretty much every organization. If any of you have gone to different organizational meetings in the last 3 years, I would say, there's probably not one that doesn't have a topic in this, because again, it is a crisis for all of us. The Action Collaborative on Clinician Well-Being and Resilience. And they have set up an opportunity for organizations to not only share their work, but to share their commitments. And they have over 100 organizations, major organizations, AAMC, et cetera, that are committed to making this happen. Now, not everybody has the right answers, but they're committed to educating people about the problem at all levels. They're committed to making sure that we understand the issues that are contributing, and they're making sure that we can begin to solve solutions and then disseminate those across schools, have standardized metrics. So there's lots being done on both levels. So this is my book. I'm very proud of this because I feel like, what can I do? I want to contribute to the culture of wellness. I teach some classes around that at the undergraduate and the medical school level. This book is called 12 Strategies for Personal Health and a Culture of Wellness. It's about my patients' stories. It's about stories of patients who happen to be medical students, residents, nurses, physicians. And I tell their story, I weave in the science about it, but I also share strategies that you can take back and apply. And I'm actually using the chapters. It's not published yet, it'll be out in the fall, but I'm using the chapters on a weekly basis with a group of what we're calling the Culture of Wellness, faculty and students together, no grade, come together and understand the issues. How do we fix this at the ground level, at the front line? So again, I bring in this improvement framework as a way of addressing strategies, as a way of us figuring out what we can do as individuals, and all of this can apply on the system level. So people familiar with PDSA, Plan, Do, Study, Act, so a basic model of preparing for a quality improvement process, an initiative. So you plan something, you do it, you see how it's working, and then you change, so you're flexible. It's a continuous quality improvement process. So it's based on this evidence-based scientific evidence. So in this case, health and wellness, there's lots of evidence out there. So we know the general literature on wellness, 30 minutes of exercise, again, lots of evidence. The context in this situation would be me. So you, what's your story? What's your environment? What are you, your culture that you live in, your SWOT, if you will, your strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats? And then what's the gap between those two? So best practice, where you are today. Where do you need to be? And then working through some rapid PDSA cycle to achieve success. And again, there's some real specific tools that will allow you to succeed. So having a global aim, SMART goals, again, analysis, measurement, et cetera, to make sure that you succeed in this process. So theoretically, this is the way the process works. You do a PDSA cycle, it succeeds. You do another PDSA cycle, you get better, you get better, you get better. But in actuality, that's probably what it looks like. One step forward, two steps back, three steps sideways, four steps back. Dr. Ogrens did this. So be prepared. Your expectation should be it's not going to always work right, but keep at it. So when I think about some of the select strategies I'll highlight, and again, we'll go into much more detail this afternoon, I'm going to start with self-awareness. So this is the key to everything. Aristotle said that. Knowing yourself is the key to success. So mindfulness is a way to do that. Self-assessment, there's lots of tools out there. Pick du jour, self-assessment, whatever it is you want to assess. Self-care, again, being authentic to yourself, making sure you have your own mission, vision, statement, and then personal resilience. And we're going to do an exercise in just a moment. Self-improvement, what are the goals when you go through all of these that you want to work on? And then I have a tool to share with you that you can take home and apply on a daily basis. So we're going to skip the raisin exercise because of flu season. We didn't want everybody walking into. How many of you have done the raisin exercise? Oh, a couple. Okay, so we will do it this afternoon. It's just a very simple mindfulness exercise. My favorite guru is Jon Kabat-Zinn. This is his. I read it verbatim, so you can go online and look at the raisin exercise. The mindfulness is an appreciation of anything in the moment without judging. It can be a raisin, and when you do the raisin exercise, it is powerful. Like, whoa, that little tiny raisin. And I've had residents say after the raisin exercise, oh my God, that was the first thing I tasted in months. So if you do that little raisin exercise and you apply that mindfulness to your patients, to your spouses, to your children, how powerful that is, to yourself. So mindfulness is a very well-studied strategy for bringing us back to the moment and appreciating what we have when we get lost in the weeds, as Dr. Levine said. So I'm going to ask you all to pass around the self-SWOTs there. This is another a generic self-assessment tool. So if everybody gets a self-SWOT, the active learner in me. So everybody has a self-SWOT. How many people have used a SWOT in an organizational strategic planning priority? How many people have done a self-SWOT before? Couple, okay. So no different than what you do when you're on your organization committee, the strengths you have, the weaknesses you have, what are some opportunities of growing your strengths, what are some threats that limit your ability to succeed? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through a resilience exercise, and I'm going to ask you to put each of these 10 factors in one of your quadrants. So is it your strength? Is it your weakness? Is it an opportunity or a threat for you? How many people have read Steve Southwick's book, Resilience? Ooh, okay, this is a must. This is a must read, add it to your list. Steve Southwick and Dennis Chamry, who I don't know as well. I've worked with Steve Southwick. He's a psychiatrist at Yale. And he and his partners and his team studied prisoners of war, special task force members, and victims of trauma at Yale Emergency Room. And they identified 10 factors. They're not magic and they're not in any specific order. But these factors were what they believe made people, and you look at resilience, bounce back, or PTG, post-traumatic growth, as opposed to post-traumatic stress. They did better after they had adverse experience. Bring on the challenge, it makes me stronger. So these are the factors. So again, the first one is optimism. When you look at what's going on in the country, how do you view it? Are you like, you know what, this is hope, we're gonna make it happen. It'll bring people together. Look at the glass half full. Where does it fall in your quadrants? Is it a strength? If it is, great. If it's not, be honest. Nobody's gonna see these, you're not passing them on. If you are coming to the workshop this afternoon, I ask you to bring them with you. We're gonna continue on that. Is it a weakness? Is it something that really threatens you that you're so negative? And again, you don't have to have all of these, but it'll be interesting to see where they fall. So the next one is around facing fear. When you're afraid, do you sit back and say, what's going on in my life? Or you deny and fill in with coping skills, whatever they be. You go for a run, you have a drink. Or do you face that fear and address it? Moral compass. Do you do the right thing no matter what? And in some of the cases in his book, they're story-based. It could mean at the expense of not only a job, but your life. Do you do the right thing when nobody's looking? Again, a source of resilience. Religion and spirituality. He studied many different religions, and there was none that surfaced as the one that he says is the top religion. It was the presence of something bigger than yourself that you believe in that made people resilient. Do you have that in your life? Don't judge yourself if you don't, but if you do, it may be a cushion for you. Social supports. Again, you can all put that in your strength because you're part of the STFM network. What other social supports do you have? Is this something that you don't have? Are you isolated in your work? Some of the biggest burnout is seen in people who work private practice, solo, unmarried, isolation. Role models. This has always been a challenge for me in terms of, do you have one at all times? Somebody that you trust, that you can rely on, that you could go to tomorrow and say, vulnerably, I am struggling, I am burned out, can you help me? Do you have that person? If you don't, it might be a wonderful opportunity. Physical exercise, mental exercise, again, not an issue for most of us, but for retiring patients, this is something that I really focus on. Flexibility and acceptance. Flexibility in your thinking. Things are not working out. Are you able to redirect, get a clean slate, cognitively reframe, and accept, let go? My daughter says, let go or be dragged. Do you have meaning and purpose? Can you use that meaning and purpose in your day? Is that something that you can pull down and say, you know what, this is hard? As Nietzsche says, those who have a why can live through any how. Do you have that why at the tip of your fingers and the tip of your tongue that you can use when times get hard? Do you have that sense of purpose in your life? So hold on to those for a minute, because as we start to say, where do these fall out? And I'll just ask, as I do at all workshops, do how many of you have everything in the strength bucket? Anyone? Everything. Nice. Stand up. We're going to give you applause. You are the first person. All right. Woo! So we want to know your secrets. We want you to share with us, but you are obviously very resilient. But those who don't have it in the strength bucket, again, you can build these, and Steve Southwick has said these are all things that we can develop. None of them are magic. You don't have to be born with them. But what I'm going to ask you to do is to consider, as you go through, an area that you might be motivated to work on. And again, thinking SMART objectives, you're familiar with this, specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and timely. You have something in your back pocket that you might want to work on. And there's two ways of thinking of choice. This is my chairman's way of thinking of making a choice. It has to be urgent, Kathy, and important. That's where I want you working. Well, that's okay sometimes, but in the chronic stress, it's probably not going to do me well. I prefer this model. How well am I? and how consistent is it with my authentic mission and vision? And sometimes we don't have the choice. We have to take call. But there are many choices we have in life that we can make based on how full our tank is and how consistent this is with what we believe in. And making choices based on that will allow you to be much more successful in our own efforts towards wellness. So these are just some of the examples that we've seen with students, with residents, with faculty and nurses that I've worked with. So I love this one, increase energy for physical exercise. So we ask everybody to do a SMART objective. You have another sheet there that works you through these that you can use at your own time or bring with you to the workshop this afternoon. Everybody who leaves the workshop will have a personal health improvement plan ready to roll. So you will be looking at something specific. So exercise is general, that's great, but you're not going to succeed if all you say is I'm going to start exercising. And we know this when we work with our patients. So you're going to be more specific, run 5 times a week for 25 minutes. You're going to have 2 metrics. One is a process metric, did you run, yes or no? And one is an outcome metric, how energized, how relaxed, how whatever you fill in the blank do you feel, 1 to 5. Achievable, these are the motivational interviewing questions and criteria in terms of success. You're more likely to succeed if your confidence rating is above 6. You're more likely to succeed if you rate your importance rating above 6. So timeliness, I always say put today in there, and I think I actually put it in on your worksheet. You don't have an option. So start today. 21 minutes is the key to making something a habit, like brushing your teeth. Most of the workshops that we do, most of the efforts is 30 days. These are some other examples. Reducing stress through mindful meditation. This is a group doing this that I've worked with in China. It's telemedicine. So they're doing a mindfulness exercise. They had enough people that committed to this process that they're doing it together during their lunch. Again, improving resilience through social connections. This was one of my favorites in an undergraduate course that I taught, where a first-year student was missing their family, their mother was ill, and she didn't have a connection. She was thinking she needed to drop out of Dartmouth and go back home. And in the middle of this course, she decided she was going to text her mother, her father, and her brother every day. That was going to be her personal health improvement project. And at first, they were alarmed. They actually thought something was wrong, until she fessed up this was an assignment. But at the end of the course, the family continued this process, and the mother sent me a thank you note. And I thought, you know something, such a simple little act made a huge impact in her life, because what she was missing was social health, social wellness. And again, very specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, start today. Appreciative inquiry, another strategy that's really powerful when we get negative. So can we, in a journal, very simply, nobody reads it, no grammar, no scientific writing, one item I did well, or identify the good in something bad that happens at the end of a day. Many people have done this. This is a tool that we've developed, and if you want to go online, it's free. You're welcome to use it. It's called www.myfit.org. It's on the sheet of paper as well. So if you prefer to do this electronically, I know the 100 students out there will go right to that model because they throw out the paper I bring. But everything is the same. So you can go on, you plan your fit, you choose a theme. I'll show you the themes. You choose a SMART objective, you write it in yourself. It takes about 5 minutes or less to set up. You set your own goals, you set your own metrics, and you can choose a team, and I'll highlight an STFM team. So if everybody in STFM wants to be part of the same team, you'll see the collate of these. You won't see any individual data. But you will track your fit for 30 days, and you can do 1 or 100 or 1,000. You can keep doing them. We have people in different places that you'll see are doing them over and over. You will get daily emails, and I have 3 fits going at the moment, so I get 3 daily emails. All you have to do is click on that. It will take you to where you track and monitor your fit. So you will know that we are all here cheering for you as you go forward with whatever your priority is. You can view your progress, and now there's a new feature that we've just developed as part of a pilot that we're running with the faculty and students as a chat. So if you're in the theme of exercise, you can say you're struggling. You can put in a little tiny blurb, and somebody out there may support you in different ways. So I invite you to join us on the MyFit project. These are the themes that we've been seeing in the Johnny Carson format. So pursuing a passion, people are like, oh, I got to get back to playing the guitar. I got to do something I used to do, art. Being positive, so appreciative inquiry. Social supports, again, students saying, I'm going to go out on Thursday night. I'm going to connect with old friends. I'm going to at least answer the emails from my mother. improving time management. I love this one combined with six. We had a resident who's like, I'm just too busy to do anything. And he decided to unplug for 3 hours a night. And oh my gosh, where did that time come from? 3 hours from 7 to 10 p.m. he unplugged, and all of a sudden he had all kinds of time to do things. Fostering reflection by journaling. Number four is sleep hygiene. Can anybody guess the top three? Eating, exercise, and the panacea these days, mindfulness. So I'm just going to leave you with one of my heroes, FIT projects. And I know Ben Franklin didn't call it a FIT. He didn't call it a personal health improvement project. But if you read his memoirs, Ben Franklin had 13 virtues. So in his 13 virtues, he believed if he did these things continuously in his adult life, he would be healthy, happy, and successful. So if you look at the first one, and I'll just read that because it might be small, temperance. Eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation. We know he didn't do that all the time, right? But he didn't have Excel, he didn't have computers, he had these little papers. And you'll see these in his memoirs. He tracked one of these items at a time for an entire week. So here's his temperance. He gave himself a black mark if he didn't succeed. It's the opposite of what I would have done. I would have given it to me if I succeeded in the positive thinking. But if he didn't succeed, he put a little dot there. So you can see he did really well. And then he would drop that one and go on to the next one the next week. So he was constantly working on a continuous improvement process of himself. And his conclusion, I never got perfect, but I always got better. I never became perfect, but I continuously got better. So now there's actually a Ben Franklin app, go figure. He would be so excited, Ben would. So if you can come up with what those 13 things are, you too can do personal health improvement in a continuous way, going from one to another to the areas of priority. It doesn't have to be 13, whatever you need. So this is individualized, whatever your team needs. And this is my team at home. Whoops. My daughter, Stephanie, at Bucknell. My daughter, Victoria, at Middlebury, and my husband, Mark, down in Cambridge. So in conclusion, taking care of ourselves is not a sign of weakness. Filling our own tanks allows us to care for others better. So I'll be cheering for all of you as you care for yourselves, as you do self-awareness to know what you need, self-care to provide it, and self-improvement continuously. And in the words of Ben, we will never be perfect, but we can continuously improve.